Welcome back to TechNet Radio. Harold Wong and Edwin Nguyen are back for today's show as they discuss the new features and improvements made in Windows Server 2012. Tune in as they discuss networking enhancements, live migration, the best way to measure performance, and what things you should consider with Hyper-V scalability. Harold, the mic is yours.
Hey, welcome to this episode of TechNet Radio. My name is Harold Wong. I am an ITE in the U.S. And with me today, I have Edwin. And so, Edwin, why don't you just take a quick minute and introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Edwin Nguyen. I'm the Director of Cloud and Virtualization Strategy here at Microsoft. I've been with Microsoft about 6 years. Actually came from a little company called Softricity that developed some virtualization technology that everyone now knows as AppV. So I've got a long history in this field.
Oh, awesome. Well, Edwin, thank you for taking time to come talk to us. I just had a few questions, right, around Windows Server 2012. That product just RTM not too long ago, and I just wanted to ask some questions and see if you could clarify a few things, right? So four things, right, that I wanted to talk about. One is networking, one is around live migration, third is performance, and the fourth is scale, because those are the big topics around Server 2012 today. So when we look at networking, I know there's a lot of enhancements in the product in Server 2012. Can you just kind of give us a little overview of some of the key things that are available in networking enhancements?
Yeah, I mean, we've worked really hard in terms of just trying to get the networking even faster than it was before. In fact, in the past, you know, I felt that we really used up a lot of what the physical adapters would allow in terms of, you know, things like why we were able to use an entire bandwidth for migration, for live migrations, and we got really, really high network performance in. But we've added a bunch of different things in for the networking now. Really, we'd recommend people, if they have it, to get 10 gigabit Ethernet. If they're not on it, it's something that we take full advantage of. I mean, in fact, really what we've done is we can really architect it for even up to like 40 gigabit Ethernet, which is just being discussed now. And we've got a number of features that allow you to offload things like virtual machine offloading. We'll do some IPsec offloading onto NIC cards. We'll do NIC teaming now that's in the box. We've got SRIOV support for some more offloading and some direct access to network adapters. Really, it's about getting as much of the performance that you have in that physical adapter straight to that virtual machine.
Okay, so you mentioned NIC teaming, right? That was something that was kind of supported, not supported, depending on what article you're looking at in 08R2. And so now I know it is just built into Server 2012. Can you kind of dig in a little bit more about that in terms of like what's required? Is there anything that we have to be aware of from a gotchas perspective?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really interesting. That was an interesting discussion before because whether or not we supported NIC teaming in the past was really dependent on a view from the VMware point of view, where if you had adapters or VMware, the drivers built in could support NIC teaming and you just connected them. What we did in Server 2008 is we were in the same situation as regular Windows. We relied on vendors to produce these drivers. You know, you go into the properties of the driver and you team it that way. What we've done in Server 2012 is really bring NIC teaming right into the operating system so it can be handled natively by the OS, and then the OS binds them together and gives you, and then presents that adapter to everything, including Hyper-V. The really nice thing about handling it at an OS level is that we actually even get away really from that driver level issue, where you don't even have to configure the driver from the OEM. You don't even have to have the same NICs from the OEM or the same speed. So you could take a Broadcom and an Intel and then team them together. You could take a 10 gig and a regular gig, or God forbid 100 meg, put them together, team them together, and just kind of pull them together for the right resiliency and the right performance. And all you really need to do is really just highlight them and then team them together. So it's a real advancement in how we use it. So it's not just do we have NIC teaming, we do, but we've really brought it in a way that makes it very flexible for a lot of us who, you know, maybe not, you know, in the super corporate environment where we've got 50 servers that are all the same and we've got the same, you know, NIC card in every box in those environments.
Okay, awesome. That's one of the things that I know I heard concerns about, right, is right. If I have the Intel built-in NIC that comes with my server and I add in a few Broadcom and a few other no-name ones because I just happen to have them, There was always concern, can I mix and match? And you just answer that. So if I actually do have 4 1-gig NICs and I team them together, am I really getting 4 gigs of bandwidth then at that point? I mean, how does the aggregation of bandwidth work in that model?
Well, in that model, the aggregation sure work and pull them together. Obviously, it also depends on what the individual NICs are connected and your bandwidth thereof. But it's for pulling not just for the bandwidth, but also for that level of resiliency that we get together. A good example in the machines is like a lot of the Intel ones are built right onto the motherboard, and then a lot of the manufacturers will ship a Broadcom or a second set. So when we look in there, you know, even Blade or just simple 1U boxes are going to have, you know, 2 to 4 adapters. You know, they're going to have a pair of Intels and a pair of Broadcoms. So by teaming those together and mixing those together, you also add a level of resiliency. I know it doesn't happen that often, but it is, you know, something that you know that, oh, okay, well, I'm not, you know, it's not you sit there and say, okay, I've run out of Intels that I want to bind together, you know, which was a situation that could have happened in the past.
Well, perfect. And then what about multipath I.O.? I mean, you're talking about resiliency in NIC teaming, but there's always this thing that we've had around for a little while called, you know, MPIO. How do those two compare? Because I know people have been asking me that question too.
Yeah, I think with MPIO, you're looking at, you know, potentially using different adapters or different systems in order to reach your paths. And you could do so at NIC teaming, but you're presenting it a little bit differently. Where with MPIO, the way you've exposed it and then you have the multipath, it's really about having it handled over at the network end rather than how it's presented onto the OS. And with NIC teaming, I think it's just a little bit different. I mean, you could do it in either way, but it also depends on what's being supported. You know, if it's a backend SAN, if it's an iSCSI SAN, there's all these different flavors that are going to be, you know, influenced by the factors. I think one of the key things that we want to talk about is just the flexibility of what you want to do. It's not, this is the way that you will get redundancy or this is the way that you'll get multipath.
Okay. No, that's perfect. I love NIC teaming because it's so much easier.
Yeah. Right?
And it still gives me that level of resiliency that you mentioned. Okay. Well, perfect. The second topic I want to hit on right now then is live migration. I know we've had live migration in 2008 R2, but what are some of the new enhancements that have come up with live migration in Server 2012?
Well, probably the big thing in Server 2012, there's two areas that we've had enhancements with live migration. The first one is that we now support essentially unlimited multiple live migrations. So in 2008 R2, we supported one live migration from one site to the other. And we did that really because we could take advantage of the full bandwidth between two servers. But there were situations, especially if you're doing, maybe you were evacuating one server and you had multiple target boxes, that if you had multiple live migrations, you could take advantage of that. So now we really have unlimited simultaneous live migration. You can select how many you want. We would still recommend people restrict it to some sense, depending, again, on your bandwidth, because obviously you're going to consume a little bit of overhead with multiple connections. But you can do and start as many as you would like at the same time and really spread them out. The other big thing that we have is that we do a lot of things. We do storage live migration now, so we can move storage back and forth. And when we have a new feature called shared nothing live migration, which is really the ability to move a VM live from one server to the other without any direct connectivity between the two with other than your Ethernet or your network connection. So unlike live migration where you had to have the backend shared storage shared together, or even in storage live migration where you could have a single server, but you're moving on the backend storage and they have to be shared, now you can simply move it together. And those are great for scenarios that maybe you're doing a cluster node to cluster, cluster to cluster migration, not within the cluster, but between clusters. That's great for an SMB type environment, really great for developers and other people that you just need to move that machine onto the other system and that you don't have to have shared storage just for that feature.
Okay, so the shared nothing live migration, that's huge, right? And if I can do that where I can have two standalone nodes, Hyper-V nodes, and I can migrate from one to the other, shared no shared storage other than the network, why in the world would I even bother to create clusters then at this point?
Well, if you have shared nothing live migration, you get that VM mobility. But, you know, we've always tried to make sure everybody understood the difference between what I call planned downtime and unplanned downtime. And live migration, or vMotion as it's called from VMware, has always been actually a discussion point on that, because people think, oh, I've got live migration, and if server A goes down, it'll just live migrate to server B, and it actually doesn't, because live migration requires the two systems to be running. So if you've got planned downtime, which is I know A is going to go down, or I know I need to move something from A to B, live migration is your choice because it keeps the state running and the users don't know. Clustering will give you that high availability, which is if A goes down, it will automatically restart on B, but the VM does reboot or restart. So you get a level of high availability for the unplanned downtime from clustering. And for live migration, you get the planned downtime. The big issue is in the past, you had to have the cluster just to do the migration, which seemed kind of silly. And also, I've got a cluster here, I've got a cluster there, I need to do maintenance on the cluster. Why can't I just evacuate it from one box to the other cluster? Why do I have to go through a bunch of different things to do migrations? So really, Shared Nothing Live Migration opens up a whole bunch of different potential possibilities, not just better thing ways to do things that we've done in the past, but really new ways to do things.
No, awesome. So I love how you describe or kind of bring up the planned versus unplanned downtime. Right? And I think that's what people really get caught up on, or they confuse. They don't think about the fact that if it's unplanned downtime, there's no way to live migrate, whether it's shared nothing or clustered, right? You can't live migrate. You have to depend on availability to come into play.
Yep.
Okay, so when you're doing all these live migrations, especially the shared nothing, because now we've got to actually migrate storage, right? Not just system state, but the storage. Are there any like guidances or best practice guidance documentation or whatnot on the number of NICs, the type of NICs, or the type of network, or even the type of storage that should be used in mm-hmm. these situations?
Obviously, the faster the better, or the closer the connection is better. I mean, we often get that, can I potentially live migrate a machine from like Redmond to Phoenix or something like that? And it all depends on the speed of the connection and how effective that can be. And then Windows Server 2012 will have ways to try to compensate, how much memory is being put across. But obviously, the larger the bandwidth, the better. What I do want to stress is there isn't the minimum, so to speak, right? We're not going to sit there and say, unless you have 10 gigabit Ethernet, this isn't going to work. What you want to do is have that ability. When you actually go ahead and do the migration, you're given different options, which is where am I going to move it to? What server am I going to move it to? What storage on that server am I going to move it to? Is it back-end storage for that server? Or maybe some servers have split storage, with local disk or RAID disk or fast SSDs. Obviously, the faster you can process and move that memory bits, the better that migration is going to be. But it's solely, up to the end user how they want to do it. A lot of people will then, will split things. They'll put maybe the OS image on one disk, data image on the other disk. So any of the best practices that you traditionally have with VMs will still apply. But again, bigger the better is what they always say. But you're not going to be restrictive in terms of what you can do.
Okay, so that's good to know. Can I really use a 100 meg connection to do a live migration, though?
Well, it all depends on the size of your VM also. Remember, it's not just the storage, because that'll take some time. You can move that. It's really about the memory that you have. I mean, obviously, it wouldn't take a 64 gigabyte, VM with probably a terabyte of storage in the back end to move over 100 megs. But
if you get a chance to test that out, let me know how many days it took for that move to complete.
Well, I always tell stories. At one point I once did TCP IP in mail on a wireless radio network for the military when I worked there, and our bandwidth was 32 kilobits. So I've seen it kind of go on a really, really slow basis. So the fact that we have 10 gig or 40 gig amazes me to this day.
Wow. Well, I'm glad I didn't have to work in that kind of an environment. That would have just, made me pull out all my hair, what little hair I have left. So thank you for clarifying a lot of things on live migration, and especially the shared nothing live migration. The third topic I really want to highlight or kind of hit on is performance. Right, we've been beat up. I've heard a lot of things in the past on 08R2 and 08 around Hyper-V and how Microsoft just doesn't seem to perform very well when you have lots of VMs or if you're trying to do high density. What have we done to really address performance in Server 2012?
Well, I do want to say that in Server 2008 R2, there was this perception that we couldn't do high performance. I want to separate performance and scalability. I think we did performance really well. I mean, we had a number of different studies out there that show we would get, you know, near 99% for disk, you know, 93, you know, between 86 and 93% in terms of CPU for high-end applications. I think that we got very close to the physical hardware. I think the issue that we had in Server 2008 R2 was really a level of scalability, where in effect, you know, we were restricted in terms of what we could do in terms of the size of scale. So we, you know, in terms of the logical processors that you could see on a server, we went, you know, we were down at 64. Now with 2012, we can do 320 addressable memory. We can only address about a terabyte of memory. Now we can address about four. The big thing that everyone always saw was how many, you know, CPUs within the VM itself. We were really restricted to four. Now we can do 64, right? Memory per VM, we were restricted to 64 before. Now we can do a terabyte. Plus we can, you know, the cluster sizes are four times big. So you're looking at four or five times improvement for most of the large scalabilities. Essentially, any workload that you want to run, you can run in Hyper-V now.
So do you actually see customers? I know we went from performance to scale because you're right. A lot of people tend to confuse, or they mix it to performance with scale. Do you see any customers, Microsoft included, today that are using 64 virtual CPUs in a VM and assigning a terabyte of RAM to that one VM?
Well, we certainly have customers who are looking into it. And, you know, everyone calls them the monster VMs. I think it may really be beyond what most people are doing. But, you know, there's two points to be made there. As I always say within the Windows Server team, and I've talked to the engineering team a lot, they test it. It's not just, oh, that's a theoretical number and they ran it one time. They run those high-end numbers. They run 60, you know, they run 64 vCPU. They run a terabyte of memory in a VM with SQL workloads, run them under load, test them out so they know it works. We know it can go to that size. But I think you make a good point. I think a lot of people are looking to scale to really eight processors. Maybe 16. I mean, it depends on the size of the boxes. If people are still buying, you know, one or two U boxes, two CPUs, we got eight cores apiece, you're looking at 16 cores. You know, most people haven't even seen a 64-core box before. But the key here is that I think going beyond four was necessary, and probably more importantly, making sure it's still scalable. I know there's always been concern that, yes, you know, maybe I could provision a 16-core or 16 vCPU VM, but it doesn't act like a 16. You know, I get a fall off compared to physical. We're making sure with things like virtual NUMA and other capabilities that when it scales right.
Okay, and you bring up virtual NUMA because that's very important, right? Because memory isn't memory. 64 gig or a terabyte of RAM is not one big chunk of a terabyte of RAM.
Right.
It's broken up into a bunch of different NUMA nodes. And I don't know if we have enough time really to dig into NUMA here. Maybe that'll be a topic for a future discussion, but I know that is important. So I'm hoping I can tap into you to talk about that at in a later episode. What do you think?
Sure, absolutely. And I will say that all the management of NUMA, understanding it's great, the management is actually handled all automatically by Hyper-V. But, you know, for those who want to play around, you can actually go into the properties of the VM and click on your virtual NUMA, and then you can do your own assignments. Not that I totally recommend that.
Okay. So now, since the team does a lot of heavy testing to actually test out these 64 virtual CPU VMs with a terabyte of RAM, do you have one of those spare servers sitting around that you can just ship over to me so I can try it as well?
I think that I can. I'm sure they'll make a laptop. I'm sure there'll be a ThinkPad that can do that in probably a couple of years. We'll see what happens. That's something I would love to take on the road because, you know, there's nothing better than to have more power.
And it would probably heat up the room as well, right? Pretty well.
Yeah. I from the boxes I've seen, it's kind of like when it's what I've always say. When they ship you a server and it's on a wooden pallet and you need a socket wrench in order to get it off the pallet, you know you got a pretty good server.
Well, awesome. I think you've taken the time to answer all the questions that I had, and I do appreciate it. So with that, I want to thank you and kind of put an end or call an end to this particular episode. So
great, thank you,
and we'll see you again soon.